Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. And I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 40. I'm recording it on November 4th, 2008. The PE10 level today is 16, which is fair value. Stocks purchased today offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is The Future of Investing, Part 4. I'm doing this series of podcasts as a sort of positive response to an earlier set of podcasts I did that was called Passive Investing is the Most Emotional Investing Approach of All. And in that earlier set of podcasts, I identified 35 warning bells that caused me to give up on the passive investing model of understanding how stock investing works. 35 discoveries that I made about the weaknesses of the passive investing model during the first 6 years of the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate. In this set of podcasts, I also look at 35 items, but the 35 items are not negative discoveries looking backward. They are positive hopes for things we need to do to change our understanding of how stock investing works in the future. So I'm looking at changes that we need to see so that we can all move forward in our understanding of how stock investing works, move from the discredited passive investing model to what I believe is the investing model of the future, rational investing. The difference between the two models is that in passive investing, you don't make changes in your stock allocation in response to dramatic price changes. You just stick with one stock allocation, even when stocks are much, much, much more dangerous than they were at the time you set that stock allocation. Rational investing is just the opposite. With rational investing, the argument is that you must make changes in your allocation in response to dramatic price changes if you are to have any realistic hope of becoming a successful long-term investor. So during the first three parts of this podcast series, I covered the first 23 of the 35 discussion points. Discussion point number 24 is simplicity. We need a focus. Item number 23 is that it argued that we need a focus on the basics of investing. Well, item number 24 argues we need a focus on simplicity. There are... I think that the best investing strategy of all is value investing, the approach recommended by Warren Buffett. And I've visited discussion boards where investors following the Buffett model discuss their strategies. And I believe that you will get the best returns possible by spending the time it would take to become an effective value investor. So why don't I advocate value investing at my site? The reason I don't advocate it is value investing is for the sophisticated investor, the investor who has time to, you know, who enjoys investing enough that he will spend time at nights or on weekends studying annual reports, researching companies, things of that nature. Most middle-class investors do not belong in that group. So for most of us, simplicity is essential. And that's why I am such an admirer of John Bogle. John Bogle put forward an approach to investing that stresses simplicity. Unfortunately, the way I've put it is that Bogle, I believe, is 60% an advocate of rational investing and 40% an advocate of passive investing. Unfortunately, because he advocates passive investing and because passive investing is so emotional, many people have jumped on that and they think of Bogle as just this passive investing advocate and they forget all of the rational investing concepts for which Bogle has been responsible. But Bogle, I think, revolutionized investing with his advocacy of the indexing approach. And I think we need to keep that in mind in our efforts to move away from passive investing to a rational investing model. So we don't need to give up indexing. Indexing is wonderful. Indexing means you obtain broad diversification at low cost. What's not to like? But under the rational model, we don't have a passive approach to indexing, and the approach recommended by Bogle, where you choose one stock allocation and then stay at that allocation regardless of what happens to stock prices. The rational investor goes with a valuation-informed indexing approach, an approach to indexing where you stay the course in a meaningful way. Bogle recommends staying the course, but he recommends staying the course, and then he also recommends staying at the same stock allocation. Obviously, both things are not possible. If you're at the same stock allocation, your risk level is changing dramatically when prices rise. Whereas if you are a valuation-informed indexer, you make the adjustments needed in your stock allocation so that you can stay the course in a meaningful way, so that your risk level remains roughly constant. Item number 25. Pushing back on the experts, demanding intellectual integrity. I've discussed this somewhat, I think, in earlier comments. I discussed the importance of identifying mistakes, and this is really just a variation of that thought. I've gotten this comment from many middle-class investors. They say, Rob, your ideas on investing, they all make sense. They make all the sense in the world, and I haven't been able to find any flaws. But I have to tell you, Rob, I can't follow what you're saying, because the big name experts, they don't say what you're saying. They don't say what you're saying. And I have to go with the big name experts. Well, I understand where those people are coming from. It's totally understandable that people would think that people who study investing must know what they're talking about, and the safe course is to go with the experts. I think that's a mistake, though. For all sorts of reasons, expertise in the investing area does not always translate into getting it right. Obviously, one big problem is that the dominant model of today gets it wrong. So the more expert you are, the more likely you are to endorse the dominant model. And the dominant model just does not get it right. Valuations do affect long-term returns. Regardless of all this advocacy of passive investing that we've seen for the past 20 or 30 years. So I think we can't stop listening to experts. We're always going to want to, you know, we can't all spend all our time studying investing. So we have to count on certain people spending more time than we do and then being able to learn from those people. So we need experts. But I think we need to push back harder on the experts. There's a real feeling in Investo world that it is somehow taboo. It is somehow not right. It is somehow impolite to question the experts when they say something that doesn't add up or that doesn't make sense. I think that's a terrible mistake. You have to push back on the experts because it's your money at risk. So if an expert tells you something that doesn't make sense, you have to ask the hard questions. And the way I justify it is, understand that you're helping the experts when you do that. The experts are human, just like you are. They make mistakes. It's when you ask them hard questions that they learn about their mistakes. They're forced to defend their ideas. They're forced to reconsider their thinking. And that's how they come around. That's how they move forward themselves. I remember that phrase that Mel Lindauer used when I announced that I would be attending the annual meeting of the Vanguard Diehards, where John Bogle would be appearing, and Mel Lindauer, co-author of The Boglehead's Guide to Investing, changed the rules for attendance at the meeting, and he said, in justifying that, he said, we have to quote-unquote protect John Bogle from Rob Bennett's questioning. We have to protect John Bogle. Well, If John Bogle needs to be protected from the questions put forward by some guy who posts stuff on the internet, it's a sad day for John Bogle, and it's a sad day for the passive investing movement, and it's a sad day for the indexing revolution when John Bogle needs to be protected from Rob Bennett's questions. Mel and I are coming from very different places on that sort of question. I respect John Bogle, and it's because I respect him that I direct hard questions to him, that I'd like him to see if he can make better sense out of his investing ideas than I have been able to make of some of them. Some of his investing ideas I endorse strongly, and others just, they just don't add up. Item number 26. Separate advice for clients. Well, I discussed this under item 22. I talked about offering separate advice for people who are not clients, for middle-class investors, and the question of whether there's a need for separate advice for clients is really just a different aspect of that same question, and I think I discussed both aspects in the earlier discussion, so I'm just going to move on from that one and see if we can. I'd like to wrap this series up here with the fourth part, so that we have a parallel to the four parts of the earlier podcast series. Item 27, distinguish short-term and long-term timing. That might be the whole ball game right there. I mentioned from time to time that I continue to this day to post at the Goon Central discussion board. And, you know, as the name implies, a lot of the posters there are goon posters, abusive posters. And I know that some people wonder, you know, why do I post there? I'm so opposed to abusive posting. Why do I myself post there? Well, I never engage in abusive posting. But I do sometimes like to hear what the goons think. And there are a number of reasons. One is just that I want to know their mindset. The goon mindset has caused such trouble. And I think the goon mindset is, to a large extent, responsible for the errors in the passive investing model. So I want to understand that. And I know a lot of the goons from earlier days when they were constructive posters. So I believe that underneath, they are humans too. And underneath, they have an interest in learning how investing works. And I like it that they can keep me honest. They pose hard questions to me, just as I pose hard questions to John Bogle. The goons pose hard questions to Rob Bennett. And I think those hard questions keep me honest. They force me to think through my ideas and present them carefully and discover weaknesses in them so that I can change my own thinking. But there's a poster there, Drip Guy, and not too long ago, I think it might have been 2 months ago, every now and then the goons put up a post that strikes me as being sincere, not their usual gamesmanship. And Drip Guy had a post where he just said, we just don't believe that it's possible to time the market. And I think those words were sincere. You know, the goons acknowledge that valuations affect long-term returns. They get annoyed when I say, you know, I'll say on these podcasts or in my articles, We need to recognize that valuations affect long-term returns. The goons will say, we do recognize it, Rob. We've recognized that from the first day. Well, if you recognize it, you should, you know, actions speak louder than words. If you recognize that valuations affect long-term returns, you should be changing your stock allocation in response to dramatic changes in valuations. And that they don't recommend. They support passive investing. But when you're trying to understand why is it that they recommend the things they do, why is it they invest in the way they do? And I think Drip Guy said it in that post from a couple months ago where he said, we just don't believe it's possible to time the market. I think that's the key to it all. And, you know, first of all, It has to be possible to time the market. The idea that it would not be possible is a complete absurdity. If valuations affect long-term returns, then Stocks do not offer as strong a value proposition when valuations are high as they do when they are low or moderate. That, nothing could be more clear. Well, if they don't offer as good a value proposition, then obviously the person who invests in stocks more heavily at times when the value proposition is strong is going to do better than the person who invests equally heavily when the value proposition is strong and weak. Again, I don't know how anyone can refute the logic. So long-term timing must work. I knew that long-term timing worked before John Walter Russell did his research. I make this point all the time. I've never had anyone respond to it. I don't know if I'm the only one who cares, but it's to me, it's a very powerful point. We started these discussions in May of 2002. I did not have the abilities to do the statistical work that John Walter Russell has done. And I was looking for someone to help do that. And people would say to me, these abusive posters would say, Rob, you know, timing doesn't work. Don't you know? It's been proven timing doesn't work. And I'd say, look, I'm sorry if you think timing doesn't work, but timing has to work. Human reason tells us that if valuations affect long-term returns, and that seems to be universally agreed, there doesn't seem to be any dispute on that. William Bernstein said that valuations affect long-term returns as a matter of, quote, mathematical certainty. You can't get any stronger than that. Well, if valuations affect long-term returns, long-term timing must work. It has to. So I said, will someone please check the numbers? So that's what John Walter Russell did. He checked the numbers, and surprise, surprise, the numbers show that long-term timing has always worked, going back to the first day. It always will work. The idea that there might be some universe in which long-term timing wouldn't work, it's irrational. That's why ultimately I came up with the name for this investing approach, calling it rational investing. The idea that long-term timing would not work is irrational. Now, I know the Trip guy and many of these other goons are rational in many other areas of life endeavor, but when it comes to thinking that long-term timing does not work, they're irrational. But I think the problem they're suffering from is they truly believe that there is research showing that timing doesn't work. But there is indeed research showing that short-term timing doesn't work. There's lots of research showing that, and I'm personally persuaded that that's the case, that short-term timing does not work. So I think that all of the friction or all the confusion that we've seen in 6 years of discussions is caused by the failure of the experts to distinguish short-term timing from long-term timing. The phrase, timing doesn't work, is one of those half-truths that I'm always complaining about, one of those marketing slogans of the passive investing model. If I were to challenge it, if I was to go to one of the experts who says it and say, how dare you say the timing doesn't work, would they have a response? Sure, they can point to the evidence showing that short-term timing doesn't work. But the phrase isn't short-term timing doesn't work. The marketing phrase is timing doesn't work. And that's false. Long-term timing has always worked. Check the historical data. And you will see. The historical data is public information. Anyone can check it. In 6.5 years, I've never had anyone challenge my statement that long-term timing works. And you can check the research done at John Walter Russell's site. You can check the calculators at my site and at John's site. You can check Robert Shiller's website where he has the historical data for downloading by anyone who wants to make use of it. Long-term timing has always worked. John Bogle says that not only does he not know anyone who has timed the market successfully. He doesn't know anyone who knows anyone who has timed the market successfully. It's a funny line, but it's a false line. John Bogle knows Mel Lindauer. He has shaken Mel Lindauer's hand. Mel Lindauer calls John Bogle his mentor. Mel Lindauer knows Rob Bennett. He changed the rules for the Vanguard Diehards meeting because he wanted to, quote-unquote, protect Bogle from hearing what Rob Bennett has to say. Rob Bennett has been successfully timing the market since 1996. I'm far ahead of the game today from where I would be if I had not timed the market. And if stocks perform in the future anything at all as they have always performed in the past, I will be much farther ahead in days to come. I am ahead today, and I will be earning compounding returns on the difference, on the amount that I am ahead of where I would be if I had followed the passive investing model. Anyone who has followed passive investing and lost money during the stock crash should count out how much he or she has lost, and then should go to one of these calculators on the website that on the internet that tell you the effect of compounding returns. Instead of using those calculators to show the benefit of saving money at a young age, use those calculators to show you the penalty for following passive investing. And what they will show you is, if you lost $10,000 over the past year, you lost a lot more than $10,000 when you take into account the compounding effect. And if you lost $50,000, you've lost a whole lot more than $50,000 when you take into consideration the effect of compounding returns. And if you lost $100,000, you've lost a whole big bunch more than $100,000 when you take into consideration the effect of compounding returns. Passive investing is a losing strategy because it always leaves you behind. We don't know when. It doesn't always leave you behind in a year or two. Sometimes it leaves you behind in a year or 2 years. Sometimes it takes 10 years. Sometimes it takes a little more than 10 years before rational investing goes ahead of passive investing. But it always goes ahead. And once it goes ahead, the compounding returns phenomenon kicks in and the rational investor goes farther and farther and farther ahead. If you want to see this play out before your very eyes, go to thepassionsaving.com and spend some time with the Scenario Surfer calculator. That allows you to compare how a passive approach to investing works to how long-term timing works. Long-term timing is the approach followed by rational investors. And you'll see that long-term timing beats rebalancing 9 times out of 10. And the one time in which passive investing works, it pays off in a nominal sense, but you're taking on added risk. You're taking on that risk that, you know, no one knows in advance that this is going to be one of the 10 times it's going to work. You're taking on greater risk. So in those few occasions where you end up a few dollars ahead, you did so at the cost of taking on much more risk with your investments. So I encourage you to do that. I think if you can understand the distinction between short-term timing and long-term timing, all the rest of this will fall into place. And so I think that's what we need to do to help the entire population move from the passive investing model to the rational investing model. We need to focus on the distinction between short-term timing and long-term timing. Don't let the experts get away with some ambiguous statement that timing doesn't work. That's not the question. The question is, does long-term timing work? And the two are as different as night is different from day. The difference is that in the short term, stock prices are determined by emotion. Therefore, timing is impossible. Effective timing is impossible because emotions are unpredictable. But in the long term, stock prices are determined by economic realities. And economic realities can be measured and can be predicted. And all you need to know whether the economic realities are on your side or not, is the price at which you purchase the stocks. If you purchase at a reasonable price, the long-term time is on your side. If you purchase at an absurdly overvalued price, the long-term is against you. Item 28. advocate the idea of people lowering their stock allocations to avoid becoming emotionally invested. Rational investors don't take a position, either pro-stock or anti-stock. We are no more pro-stock than passive investors. We are no more anti-stock than passive investors, in by definition. You know, obviously, some of us are more pro-stock than others, and some passive investors are more pro-stock than others. But passive investing as a model is neither more pro-stock or more anti-stock. But there's one sense in which what rational investors would tend to do is to have higher stock allocations than passive investors at times of low prices, and lower stock allocations than passive investors at times of high prices. We change our stock allocations, and so in relative terms, we would probably have more invested in stocks at times of low prices because the risk is so much lower that if you're trying to keep your risk level constant, you would have a higher allocation at times of low prices, and of course a lower allocation at times of high prices. But there's one sense in which rational investors might be slightly less pro-stock than passive investors, and that is that rational investors look at the not only at the economic realities, but also at the emotional realities. And one of the realities of investing is whatever you invest in, you become emotionally invested in. If you're invested heavily in Treasury inflation-protected securities, you're always going to read arguments favoring Treasury inflation-protected securities with a little more openness than someone who was not invested in TIPS. And if you're heavily invested in stocks, you're always going to read articles advocating stocks with a more open heart than if you're someone who is going with a lower stock allocation. That's just human nature. But we want to avoid becoming too emotionally invested in any asset class. You don't want to become emotionally invested in TIPS. You don't want to become emotionally invested in real estate. You don't want to become emotionally invested in bonds. You don't want to become emotionally invested in stocks. So you might want to go with a slightly lower stock allocation. You can't take this too far. If you didn't want to become emotionally invested in stocks at all, you might argue that you need to always go with a low stock allocation, because stocks, they have a strong emotional pull on us. But if you go with a low stock allocation, you'll end up paying a very big price in terms of lost returns over the course of a lifetime. So I don't advocate that. But I do think that in a close call where you're trying to decide, you know, we all have to set our stock allocation by looking at our personal financial circumstances, our risk tolerance, and our life goals. And say that you look at those things and you determine that your proper stock allocation is 70%. I could see, but you're not sure. You think it's somewhere between 60 and 70. I think at a time of moderate valuations, I think that someone who was unsure of going with 60 or 70 might choose to go with 60 on the grounds that the risk of becoming emotionally invested in stocks and therefore becoming less rational in his decision-making process might tilt things towards the lower stock allocation. So this is something that we should be advocating that people consider. I'm reluctant to argue that people should go too far with it. I think it could be taken too far. But stocks are an asset class with an emotional pull, and that's dangerous, and that justifies it on close calls, in some cases, going with the lower stock allocation, in my belief. Item 28. That was item 28. Item 29. Humility as a prime virtue. You heard me earlier in the last podcast, part three, the future of investing, part three, I got a little hot about the arrogance of the passive investing dogmatist. Well, arrogance hurts us. Fear hurts us. Greed hurts us. Guilt hurts us. Shame hurts us. Arrogance hurts us. Anger hurts us. Hate hurts us. All these negative emotions. Humility is one of the investing virtues. If we all could become more humble as investors, so many of these problems I've talked about in the first three parts of this podcast series could be solved. The whole problem of not allowing different viewpoints on discussion boards, that wouldn't happen if stock investors practiced humility as an investing virtue. The whole problem of experts not being willing to acknowledge getting the numbers wrong in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, that wouldn't be a problem if investing experts practiced humility as an investing virtue. Stock crashes wouldn't happen if we practiced humility. Remember that saying, the harder they come, the harder they fall? Humility. Pride comes before a fall. Pride comes before a stock crash. The humble investor is open to other points of view. The humble investor wants to know what he's doing wrong. The humble investor wants to know about the benefits of alternate asset classes. Humility will take you a long way in this game. Pride leads to bragging. So many reports we hear of why stocks are so great are put forward by bragging posters. Posters who are bragging. Posters who probably aren't even telling the truth about the returns they obtained. We need humility. And we need to discount points when we're listening to others give viewpoints on investing who lack humility. When you hear comments that lack humility, you should discount points. Now, this should be obvious. In all other areas of life endeavor, people would acknowledge this is a good thing to do. But in the investing area, how often you hear people say, they'll say, oh, so-and-so, they doubled their money in 5 years. They're smart. They're successful investors. No. If they doubled their money in 5 years, it's a sign that they were doing something risky, something that's probably not for you. Yes, they got away with it, if they're telling the truth. They got away with it. But that doesn't mean you'll get away with it. What happens in a saying that I have about bull markets, I say, the worst rise to the top in bull markets, the most proudful, the worst braggarts rise to the top in bull markets. People who got lucky, people who put too much money in stocks and got lucky, will tell all the rest of us what we should be doing with our money. No. Humility is a prime virtue in investing. Item number 30. Recognize the benefits of discussion boards. I am a big believer in the internet discussion board as an important communications medium of the future. I talked about this a little bit in the item that I called Behavioral Finance 2.0. Discussion boards allow us to learn things about the emotional side of the investing project that we were not able to learn until this new communications medium came along. And the discussion board is in the early years of its development. Motley Fool was the leader at an earlier time. I have a great fondness for the Motley Fool site because they were one of the leaders in building discussion boards. And their discussion boards at one time were the most civil on the internet. And they had strongly worded rules to protect us from abusive posters. And when Motley Fool started charging for the use of their discussion boards, I viewed that as possibly a good move. There needs to be a charge. Because if the site owners don't charge, one of the reasons why discussion boards are administered so poorly is that most of them don't charge. And if you don't charge, you're not going to want to hire employees to monitor the boards. And that leads to abusive posting. That just encourages the problem. So when Motley Fool started charging, my hope was that they would spend the money it took to produce higher quality boards. And unfortunately, that opportunity was lost. They seemed to go in the other direction. They seemed to take the attitude, if we're charging, we need to be popular. We need to do whatever's popular. And that means if the goons are in the majority, as they are on the passive investing question, obviously, passive investing is always going to be popular at times of high prices. So if the goons are advocating passive investing, we have to let them do whatever they want. We can't call them on their nonsense. We have to let them destroy our boards. And I think that was a tragic mistake. But it's not a mistake made only by Motley Fool. It's a mistake that's been made at other sites. And I hope that as more people come to recognize the value of discussion boards, we will see better administration. We will see discussion boards treated with more respect. I respect discussion boards greatly. Why do I respect them so much? Because they are comprised of people. And the people that contribute to discussion boards are worthy of our respect. They are human beings. They are human beings who take time out of their day to share ideas and strategies with us without compensation. They merit our respect. I wish that everyone would read the rules for posting at the Motley Fool board. Don't look at the practice. Don't look at what actually is done. Don't look at what the site administrators permit. But read the rules. The rules show respect for the people who built those boards. And I respect the people who built the Motley Fool Retire Early board. I think they deserve better than they've gotten, a lot better. And we all should show greater respect for discussion boards. And discussion boards can help us make this transition from passive investing to rational investing. They can help us understand things that the experts are not going to help us with. The experts have all the pressures that they have to deal with, and they're not going to be the leaders, I don't think. I think the leaders are going to be the middle-class investors who are suffering the effects of passive investing. They're going to be the people that lead us out of the wilderness. Item 31. All participants need to take responsibility for the input on discussion boards. This is obviously a related point, but the point here is that many things have shocked me during the great safe withdrawal rate debate. The thing that has shocked me more than anything else is the participation by big name experts at board communities where egregiously abusive posting is practiced and tolerated. I find this behavior shameful. I have an article at my website. It's at the Heroes and Villains section. It's called John Bogle's Big Mistake. And I talk there about the error in John Bogle's thinking, where he argues that it's possible to stay the course without changing your stock allocation in response to price changes. The two ideas are in direct conflict. If you want to stay the course, you need to stay roughly at the same risk level. And Bogle urges just the opposite. He says, stay at the same. He uses the phrase, stay the course, but what he really advocates is stay the allocation. He says, stay the same allocation, which means allowing yourself to be blown wildly off course. Now, that's a mistake. John Bogle's a human, just like Rob Bennett, just like everyone else. and any of us can make a mistake. So that doesn't shock me. But John Bogle today participates at the Vanguard Diehards board community and at the Bogleheads.org community. He's allowed his name to be used at the Bogleheads.org community. And Bogle's endorsement of that board has helped it to gain a level of popularity it never could have gained on its own. The Bogleheads.org board was linked to at Money Magazine. That board community would have never received that link, in my opinion, but for its endorsement by John Bogle, who was obviously one of the biggest names in investing today. John Bogle should not be endorsing that board. Not for so long as a ban on honest posting on safe withdrawal rates and other valuation-related topics remains in effect. And a ban on valuation-informed indexing. Valuation-informed indexing is the future of indexing. John Bogle is the primary person responsible for the indexing revolution. And his ideas on indexing, passive indexing, have failed. They failed in the real-world test. And so John Bogle should be doing all he can to move people to adoption of the valuation-informed indexing approach, which I believe is the future of indexing. But the Bogleheads.org community bans discussion of valuation-informed indexing, as does the Vanguard Diehards community, which has the name, not Bogle's name on it, but has the name of Bogle's company on it. Bogle should not be lending his name in support of these board communities. I would not do it. I would not do it. I will do all I can to help build those communities. I spent 2 years building up the Vanguard Diehards board. I would do it again. I would do it again if the board were opened to honest posting on safe withdrawal rates and other valuation-related topics. But I post honestly or I post not. So long as the ban on honest posting remains in effect, you will not see Rob Bennett's name appear at that site, at that board. And that shouldn't just be me. That should be John Bogle. Whether he understands or appreciates the failings of the passive investing model or not, it doesn't take an IQ of 140 to know that deception posting or intimidation posting or word game posting or smear campaign posting is out of order. So if it's not only Bogle, Larry Swedrow posts at those boards, Rick Ferry, William Bernstein. I'm not sure that Bernstein still posts there, but he did it one time. But it may be that Bernstein, I don't know. I've heard reports that Bernstein stopped posting when the posting got too abusive. I don't know if that's a fact or not. But if it is, I applaud him for that. But experts should not be giving their names to these board communities that where the abusive posters are out of control. You know, we all have responsibilities to our fellow community members. And one of the responsibilities is to stand up for community members who are under attack by goon posters. And to turn your eye away and to pretend you don't see what's in front of you. Not good. Not good. Number 32. We need to stress the importance of a sense of humor in investing. The passive investing model is a heavy model. It's a model advocated by people who take themselves entirely too seriously. This goes back to my comment earlier. I think the first part of this series, or possibly the second. I think it was the first, where I talked about the correspondence I had with the guy at indexuniverse.com where he talked about, any article I would write for the site would have to include references to the Sharpe ratio. Like Rob Bennett's going to start writing about the Sharpe ratio. Whenever I write about the Sharpe ratio, it's to tell a joke. And we all need to learn to laugh. We all need to not take ourselves so seriously. I think this is, I say this with a somewhat lighthearted spirit, but there's a deep truth here. There's a deep truth here. Sometimes I ask myself, I always compare investing to other life endeavors. I say, no other area of life endeavor are things handled in this way. And, you know, sometimes I ask myself, well, why is that? Why is it that investing goes by these special rules? And I think a big part of it is that it's very paradoxical, but a big part of it is that investing is so important. It's important in that it determines what our life opportunities will be. You know, how we invest determines what our life opportunities will be. So it's important in that way, but it's also measurable. It's not only important, the importance is measurable. So when someone gets a number wrong in a study, they not only hurt you, they hurt you in a quantifiable way. You know, you can count it. You can say, I lost $300,000 because of these demonstrably false safe withdrawal rate claims. And I think that's why there's such reluctance to acknowledging mistakes, acknowledging errors. I think some of these people may be afraid of lawsuits. You know? Everyone's afraid of lawsuits in our society today. And of course, the goal should be avoid lawsuits by not harming people. But I think that sometimes becomes twisted. The idea becomes avoid lawsuits by giving the conventional advice. And even if the conventional advice is wrong, just keep giving it. Because as long as it's conventional, you know, you won't be sued. How often have we seen John Graney point to what the experts say? Say, John, valuations affect long-term returns. Your study doesn't include any adjustment for valuations, John. People's retirements are going to fail. And he'll say, Bill Bernstein doesn't think the studies are analytically invalid. Scott Burns doesn't think they're analytically invalid. And he's right. Bill Bernstein says that anyone using one of the old school studies to plan a retirement, he says, forget about it, should forget about it, but he won't use the phrase analytically invalid. So Graney is right. Now, I don't think that makes it responsible. Just because an expert does something wrong doesn't justify John Graney or anybody else doing something wrong. But it's there's something at work here. And I think what may be at work is that there's such potential for lawsuits in the investing area because it's so important and because errors can be, you know, the effect of errors can be quantified, that people feel that they all better stick with the conventional advice. So if the conventional advice is wrong, you're going to have everybody sticking with it. It's like they take comfort. They take comfort in saying, well, this is what the textbooks say. And if someone comes on a discussion board and points out that it's analytically invalid, well, I'm just going to keep saying it. You know, and I've had people threaten me with lawsuits for getting the number right. I had Granny one time. He put up a post saying I was going to get the death penalty. Said he was going to bring me up for a lawsuit in, you know, whatever district he lives in Texas somewhere. And he said, you know, my area has the highest number of convictions under the death penalty. You know, Rob Bennett's going to get the death penalty. Rob Bennett reported the safe withdrawal rate accurately, so we're going to send him up for the death penalty. That's how upside down Investo world can get. You know, there's this saying, they talk about banks being too big to fail. You know, it's paradoxical. in capitalism, the usual rule is if you mess up, you go out of business, you lose money. But when there's a big company, they say, well, we can't let it fail because they hire all these workers. You know, there's too much riding on it. This company's too big to fail. I think there's some of that at work in with the investing, you know, with the passive investing model. It's so many people have been taken in by it. So many people have made poor investing decisions as a result of the passive investing concept that we can't acknowledge the failure. You know, we had Rob Arnott ask 200 academics, do any of you believe in the efficient market theory? And not one raised his or her hand. But then he said, how many of you are going to use the efficient market theory in your research when you go back to the office Monday? And nearly all of them raised their hand. No rational person can believe in this theory after it's been discredited. And these people, of course, know about the research that's been done, discrediting it, dating back to the 1980s. But they don't dare stop using it, because that would mean going out on their own. That would mean taking a chance. That would mean trying to come up with a model that works. And then, of course, it's all circular. Then you talk to Michael Kitsis about, well, why don't financial planners move to a new model? And he says, well, it's true that a lot of us know the efficient market theory doesn't work, but we can't go to a new model because no new model's been proven yet. Well, how's it going to be proven if we don't discuss it? See, in any other area of life endeavor, when one model fails, the next day people start building a new model. But in the investing realm, the idea is, no, that's too dangerous. We don't dare take note that the retirement advice that we've been giving for 20 years, 30 years, is wrong. We just keep giving it, which means more people suffer. More retirements fail. Oh, does that ever need to change? You know, maybe that's one of those areas that needs to change through regulation. I don't know. But I would like to see a change by people developing more of a sense of humor. How about just laughing about it? How about, you know, I have said before, I think it'll be a great day when we can all look back and say, can you believe that once upon a time we thought that you could give the safe withdrawal rate and it would be the same number no matter what the valuation level was on the day you retired? And people would just laugh and they'll just say, yeah, I mean, you know, duh. Valuations affect long-term returns, duh. But that's what we do. That's what we do. We need to learn to laugh at ourselves. Because I think if we laugh at ourselves and we don't take ourselves quite so seriously, we'll be a little more open to just being human and come forward to people and say, look, I didn't mean to cause your retirement to fail. I didn't mean for you to lose your life savings. I was just reporting what I read in some books, and we've learned that it's wrong, and here I want you to know. I want to protect you. I want to help you. Be a little human. One of the things humans do is they make mistakes. And one of the things humans do is they laugh at themselves when they make mistakes. So let's work on our sense of humor as we make this transition from passive investing to rational investing. Item 33, song lyrics. I'm known for using song lyrics in my post on investing. And there's a purpose there. I'm trying to get people out of this artificial world of the efficient market theory, which is just a made-up artificial world. And I'm trying to get people to relate to how they know the world works when they're dealing with any subject other than investing. The Beatles had a song. If I fell in love with you, would you promise to be true? That's investing. If I fell in love with stocks, will stocks be true to me? You never know the answer, do you? You never know the answer. That's why buy and hold is a lot harder in the real world than it is in this artificial made-up world of the efficient market theory. In the real world, you know, in the made-up world, you can look at all these made-up simulations and say, oh yeah, if I hold stocks, I'll get my money back. I went through this price crash, but I'll get my money back. In the real world, you never know. And that's how it is with love. You never know. I mean, you can say the right thing to do is be true. Be true. Have faith. But it's hard. Well, that's the work. That's the work you need to do to become an effective investor. You don't need to read more books. You don't need to learn more about the Sharpe ratio. Heaven help us. Sharpe, I'm never going to forget that one. That guy who told me he couldn't run an article on valuation-informed indexing unless I included a reference to the Sharpe ratio. I'm never going to give that one up. I think that was the bottom. That was the bottom of the great safe withdrawal rate debate. It doesn't get any lower than that. Just try to understand investing the way you understand other elements of life, and it'll all work out fine. But on the one hand, that's easy to do. Stock investing is not hard to understand intellectually. But that doesn't mean it's easy to do emotionally. Emotionally, it's hard. It's hard. You don't know whether stocks are going to be true. And you see, the response of the passive investors, because they don't know and they're scared. They don't know if stocks are going to be true. If they fall in love with stocks, they don't know what's going to happen. Their response is the response of a coward. I don't mean that harshly, but I have to say what's real. It's cowardly to just become dogmatic. Close your mind. Just repeat these slogans like an automaton, like some robot. True love means being vulnerable, putting yourself at risk. And true love involves some caution at times. It doesn't mean putting all your money in stocks. It means keeping a little of your heart private, keeping a little bit safe, so that you'll be able to be true with the part that you let be vulnerable. Love is taking chances, but it's not all taking chances. It's taking chances and being safe in the right proportions. We don't learn about that in the literature on the efficient market theory. We sure don't learn about it by exploring Sharpe ratios. We learn about it by listening to Beatles songs. And those of us who know a lot of Beatles songs, we've got a head start. We've got a head start over the passive investing enthusiasts. That much is for sure. Item 34, accept the implications of market cycles. Again, I mentioned just above that I sometimes try to answer, why is it that investing is so different from so many other areas of life endeavor? Why is it that the rules that apply in other areas of life endeavor don't apply to stock investing? And one of the reasons is that stock investing is governed by cycles. Instead of being an upward line of progress, stock investing takes place in cycles. So there are cycles that are called bull markets where people become wildly irrational in favor of stocks. And then there are cycles called bear market cycles where people become wildly irrational in opposition to stocks. And the successful investor has to find emotional balance in this world of extreme emotions. And if you just accept going in that everything's governed by these cycles, then what goes on won't strike you as such a shock. So my answer to these people who say, Rob, your advice makes sense, what you're saying makes sense, but I can't go with it because the big name experts, they're not saying what you're saying. Well, the reason for that is that the big name experts are influenced by the cycle. You're listening to what the big name experts say during a time of insanely high prices. And the advice coming out of the mouths of the big name experts will be very, very different when prices are at low levels from what it is when prices are at high levels. Well, if it is your goal to be a buy and hold investor, you're not going to get there by listening to the experts, because they're going to tell you totally different things at these two different times. You're going to have advice that works in both bull and bear markets. And that's rational investing. Item 35 on our quest for finding changes that we need to make in our understanding of how stock investing works to lead us from the failed passive investing model to the investing model of the future, rational investing, is stress the good side of price drops. Price drops. I believe that the ideal price is the fair value price. So if prices are below fair value, I root for price increases. If prices are above fair value, I root for price drops. Too many investors look at price increases as always being a good thing and price drops as always being a bad thing. And that's wrong-headed thinking, and I think it's thinking encouraged by the passive investing model. If you intend to be purchasing stocks throughout your lifetime, you should want stock prices to be low, not high. You don't want to pay excess prices. This is why stocks produce such bad returns at the end of, in the aftermath of huge bull markets. Bull markets take stock prices up to these absurd levels, and then you buy at the absurd levels, and you can't obtain a decent return. Your return is negative or very low. You should not be rooting for absurdly high prices. Today, prices are down at fair value, and that's good. But a lot of people are hoping that they'll go back up to where they were 12 months ago, and that would be terrible. That's the worst of all worlds. That would mean that we need to suffer another price crash. And each price crash we suffer causes more emotional mayhem. Price drops are good when stocks are overvalued, because they allow us to buy stocks at better prices, prices that from which we can obtain strong long-term returns, and they reduce the disruption to the economy caused by price crashes. You see, if we had a price drop once stocks rose above 20, once the PE10 level went above 20, we never would have suffered this price crash that we've suffered. It's because we let things get out of control that this happened to us. And so we need to spread that word. We need to get that message out to all stock investors, so that the next time, and it could be, in another month or two, we don't know. It could be in the short, it might not be all that far off. The next time we hit a PE10 level of 20, we should all be working together to bring stock prices down as quickly as possible. And we do that by getting the message out about how dangerous stocks are when we go above a PE10 level of 20. When that day comes that middle-class investors behave responsibly in the face of absurd price increases, that's the day we will be able to say, we have buried the passive investing model 10 feet in the ground. We have grown up as stock investors. We have become rational investors, we have discovered together the future of investing. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.